Of the Center for Global Development, and I'm very pleased to see all of you and to welcome you, and to have the honor of introducing to you Dominique Strauss-Kahn. As you all know, he is the Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, and he will speak to us on helping the low-income countries cope with the global financial crisis. I hope broadly also on the implications of the crisis and the post-crisis world we all look forward to for the role of the IMF in low-income countries. Monsieur Strauss-Kahn took up leadership of the IMF not quite 2 years ago, and what an extraordinary 2 years it has been for the world and for the IMF, and I'm sure for the managing director. When he started, the IMF seemed to be sinking into irrelevance and obscurity. And that was not only because of the declining demand for its lending, its loans, because of very high private capital flows, but also because of its apparent inability, even via naming and shaming, to be effective in disciplining two of its most powerful members, China and the US, to mend their ways that were contributing to the global imbalance, which in turn played some role in, if not in causing and exacerbating the crisis. On the decline in lending, I do want to say that last night on the Jim Lehrer News Hour, the managing director was terrific, and he made the nice point that you still need the fire brigade even when you've put out most of the fires. And that is the point. He was emphasizing that the IMF has a role beyond lending in many other areas of surveillance. That's where the IMF really provides a kind of global public good. In any event, in his first year at the IMF, Mr. Strauss-Kahn did something very important, which was to take up the cudgel of reform that had been started under Rodrigo Durato. And maybe the cudgel's the wrong metaphor. Maybe I should say he nudged along with the members the reform effort in terms of quota and other governance reforms, as well as thinking about new facilities that would be more flexible and responsive to the developing countries. And I think, although we'll never know, I think that that was important in making it a little easier, a little more likely, because of some credibility having been developed and some sense of commitment from his leadership, that the G20 in London was one more factor, maybe not the key one, but an important factor in the G20's commitments or promises to raise at least $750 billion that the IMF would have at its disposal to cope with the crisis. So what he did in the first year was important. Since then, since the crisis, now just a year ago, it's amazing the progress on flexibility and responsiveness that the IMF has made, particularly with respect to emerging market lending. I think maybe we'll hear a little bit more about responsiveness to the needs of low-income countries this morning. So the point, in a way, is that the IMF members and the world were lucky to have Mr. Strauss-Kahn at the helm over the last 2 years. Lucky to have someone ready, I would say in spirit as well as in experience, to take up that cudgel and to move in the last year as well. Now, let me say something about his experience. Many of you may know, but I didn't actually know so much about his background as I thought I did when I looked at the bio. Mr. Strauss-Kahn has a PhD in economics from the University of Paris, and he taught at Sciences Po, one of the most distinguished centers of excellence in France. He was a minister of trade and industry, that he was in the National Assembly. He practiced law, something that we can't do in America. We don't let lawyers be economists be lawyers and lawyers be economists usually. In 1997, he was asked by Jospin, Prime Minister Jospin, to become Minister for Economics and Finance. And he, it's very interesting, he led the socialist government's reforms in the direction of adjusting to a more globalized economy, including privatization reforms. And this was also the period when there was the enlargement of Europe, the introduction of the euro, and so on. So in a sense, I think he had practice in nudging along the French political system into a realistic acceptance of some of the realities of competition and how to be competitive in a globalized world. And it's interesting also to see about a socialist government because of the debates now in the US. I think most American politicians who saw and heard Mr. Strauss-Kahn yesterday on the Jim Lehrer NewsHour would be surprised to hear that he is a socialist. I think that reflects more about the politics here than about the realities in the world, which have to do in the end with what I think of in terms of the leadership that I've seen in the last couple of years at the IMF, which is the right combination of hard-headedness on the big issues of reform and adjusting to a globalized system, and soft-heartedness. Maybe that last part comes from a socialist background. With that, to you, Mr. Strauss-Kahn. We look forward to your remarks.
Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to be part this morning of this very important conversation. And I would like to thank Nancy for his kind remarks and the CGD for organizing this event. 6 months ago, I had a similar talk at the Brookings Institution. And shortly after this talk, the IMF had a very important conference in Tanzania trying to find out what we did well and what we did wrong in Africa during the last decade. The outcome of this conference was that most of the African countries represented at the conference asked us, because it was at the eve of the G20 in London, asked us to represent, to be one possible voice of the African countries at this G20, because at the G20 there are some African countries, but let's say most African countries don't feel really represented. So that's what I did. And the outcome of that was that even if it was not at the beginning on the agenda, the G20 asked the IMF to double its lending capacity to low-income countries. And this has been seen by most of African countries, probably low-income countries in general, as a big achievement, because it showed not only that we may have some results, and I will elaborate a little more on this later, but also that this G20 body was likely to take into account low-income countries' problem, which was not that obvious at the beginning. And so, half a year later, I return to this topic. And well, as always, I have some bad news and some good news. I think the good news are much more numerous than the bad news. What are the bad news? The bad news are that the low-income countries have been hit hard by the crisis, and harder than we thought at the beginning 6 months ago or 1 year ago. The good news is that the governments responded aggressively more than in the past, and that as countries ease their macroeconomic policies, the IMF financing provided some much-needed breathing space. So this policy response plus the recovery, the start of the recovery in the world, leads me to be rather hopeful. But of course, the low-income countries remain highly vulnerable, and the financing needs for the coming years, this year and the coming year, remain great. So there's no place for complacency. So let me begin with the crisis itself in the low-income countries, and then I will move to the role of the IMF. Obviously, the low-income countries are innocent victims of this crisis. They didn't do in the past the mistakes which were mistakes from the advanced economies in the financial sector. Contrarily, many did the right things. They have been, during the last decade, strengthening their fiscal position. They have been reducing debt burdens, bearing down on inflation, liberalizing product markets, and building, for some of them at least, comfortable reserve cushions. Of course, they have been helped by the debt relief, very well, but finally, they have been rewarded of those difficult reforms, and the result, we know all the result. The result is the longest and broadest economic expansion in modern history for most of the low-income countries. Then came the reversal of fortune. First, of course, the food and fuel price crisis. We all remember this. And just after, the global crisis made a landfall. And it was the crisis landed with great ferocity. So growth in 2009 is dropping to less than the half of the pre-crisis rates, which is worse than what we expected last March. This crisis is striking the low-income countries through many different channels. Trade has slumped. Remittances, which are a lifeline for many families, have plummeted. FDI flows to low-income countries may fall by 25% this year. And aid flows have not kept pace with the Green Eagle commitments. So what about the financial channels? As we could expect, banks in the low-income countries typically cleared off subprime mortgage loans. But still, some experience trouble with liquidity and are facing higher financing costs. So all this means slower credit growth, which reinforces the slowdown. All of us, not only the IMF, is expecting recovery, global recovery, to take place in the first half of 2010, with some countries maybe going faster. And this will mean rising world demand, and of course, it will benefit to the low-income countries. So there's an end in sight. But as I said before, we cannot be complacent. Poorer countries, especially the poorest countries, may suffer after effects for a year to come. And there are also risks of new shocks. The ongoing drought in East Africa is a terrible example. As many as 17 million people are facing today severe food shortages and may need emergency food aid. So even if things are going better, even if we have some light at the end of the tunnel, we should never forget what is at stake. A few percentage off the growth rate is certainly a big deal in an advanced economy. It means less purchasing power, it means more unemployment, but it's even much more than that for low-income countries. If our friend from the World Banks are right, they are expecting an additional 90 million people to be pushed into extreme poverty during the year coming. So what is the question of unemployment, and I'm not underestimating it, in advanced economy is a matter of life and death in low-income countries. We could see some social strife, political instability, and even war. And that is what it's all about. We need to help low-income countries in general, South African countries especially, not only because the resources we provide are needed for growth, but also because it's needed to keep peace. So, against this background, what have been the policy responses in the low-income countries? From this point of view, we have some good news. They run good policies. foundation to ward off the storm. And that's something new. In the past, many low-income countries have been facing such a, if they had been facing such a financial squeeze, would have to be would have been forced to slash government spending, to put administrative constraints on imports, or simply not to pay the bill, making the crisis worse. This time is different. Debt position had improved substantially, providing some space for counter-cyclical policy. Two-thirds of low-income countries are at low or moderate risk of debt distress. This flows from better policies, also from more aid, and also from debt relief. Of course, we all want fiscal policy to counteract the crisis, not make it worse. And that's exactly what is happening. In more than three-quarters of the low-income countries, we see budget deficit increasing, get bigger as revenue fell. In one-third of them, has been introduced, they introduced some discretionary fiscal stimulus. So this idea, which I've read in some papers, that finally the claim for fiscal stimulus was a rich country privilege, it's just wrong. Everywhere where it was possible, of course it was not possible in all and every countries, but everywhere where possible, including a large set of low-income countries, were able, because of the right policy being implemented before, to have this kind of fiscal stimulus either through the automatic stabilizer or with discretionary stimulus policy. Another benefit of the situation is that we were able, they were able, to protect the poorest and the most vulnerable part of the population. You know, when food prices triple, when jobs are lost, when remittance flow are severed, public social benefit are the only answer for many. And when I look at the figures, I see that out of 27 low-income countries with available data, 26 out of 27 have preserved or even increased their social spending during the crisis. In all of this, let's not downplay the risk either. When the recovery arrives, then we will really have to look deeply into debt sustainability. But it's not the time to do so now. That's not the time for advanced economy to organize the exit strategy. We have to think about it, but not to implement it now. The same thing is true for low-income countries. And low-income countries should not be forced to tighten their policy too soon and risk jeopardizing the recovery, simply because they could not get affordable financing. And that's why scale-up concessional financial support is so important. So let me turn to this point now. How the world community had supported the low-income countries by providing more concessional financing. That's one of the results of the G20 meeting in April in London. I'm very proud of what has been decided, and even more proud of the fact that we were able to implement it. I think really that the IMF has played its part, going beyond what was asked by the G20 in April. Basically, what the G20 asked in April was to implement over two or three years $6 billion lending capacity to low-income countries at more concessional rate than before. So we have been bumping up our concessional lending to $17 billion through 2014, front-loading the $17 billion so that in the coming 2 years, the first 2 years, the amount we will be able to lend will be $8 billion, not $6 billion. Let's put this in a perspective. The support we will provide at the IMF to low-income countries in 2009 and 2010 is more than the triple that has been available before the crisis. That's totally unprecedented, but of course, it's not enough to double the resources we are likely to lend. We also need to make it possible for the countries to borrow. So at the same time, we doubled the limits, the access limit for those countries. So in a parallel path, we had more resources and the countries are more likely to use them. Another point of the decision made in April in London, and which has been implemented during the last 6 months, was the issuance, as you know, of $250 billion SDRs. This has been done end of August. It's now in place. The different countries received the SDRs according to quota, which means that for all countries, but it's more important for low-income countries, of course, than for the US or for European countries, they received a large amount of SDR, which are part of their resources, which is a resource asset for the central banks, and which, of course, helps to fight any kind of speculation. For low-income countries, the share of this is 18 additional billion, which comes on top of the lending capacity I was just described. But, of course, the question is not only how much we lend, but the question is also about how we lend. And we want to do it faster than we did before, cheaper, and we want to do it in a way which is better focused on the needs of our membership. So cheaper, we decided, at least through the end of 2011, and we'll see what's going on after, to lend at a zero interest rate. Difficult to be lower. So for the first time in history, the fund will be lending at a zero interest rate until the end of 2011, and at this time we will see where the average interest rate in the world is. But even if the interest rates are rising at this time, we will go on lending in a more concessional way than we did it in the past. So what I want to explain just is that our commitment to low-income countries is a lasting one. Of course, different countries have different needs, and we need a variety of different lending windows, more flexible, better tailored to the need of the countries. In the past, until recently, the centerpiece of the biggest tool, the most important tool we had to lend to low-income countries was the PRGF, the Poverty Reduction and Growth Facility, which was designed to address deep-rooted balance of payment problems that required long-term structural solutions. Today, some countries may have the same challenges, and so we have a successor to the PRGF, which is called ECF, Extended Credit Facility, which more or less works as the PRGF did. But other countries may only need something when they hit a bump on the road. And a bump on the road means temporary financing gap, and so needs a temporary financing facility. So, as it did exist in the past and still exists for emerging countries, we create a standby credit facility for low-income countries. Because at the end of the day, there was no reason why this kind of facility could be available for emerging countries and low-income countries were restricted to one type facility, which was the PRGF, whatever the merits of this facility. So we create a second facility, a standby credit facility for low-income countries, which is a short-term borrowing, but of course on concessional terms. That's different with the emerging countries process. On top of that, it can also be used on a precautionary basis, which was a big fight because some of the members of the institution, for good reasons, believed that the precautionary standby facility was not appropriate. Finally, the majority decided it was needed as a kind of security blanket for those countries. Of course, being precautionary, the cost is much lower because you don't need really to borrow, you just have it and be able to use it when necessary. Then there's a third option. After the extended credit facility and the standby credit facility, the third option wants to address another kind of problem, which is the problem arising from a natural disaster or external shock. Or even without a natural disaster, the situation of countries with very limited capacity for policy adjustment, that they need something which doesn't require too much policy adjustment because they just can't do it for political reasons or for other reasons. And that's what we call now the rapid credit facility for smaller amounts, but with lighter policy conditions, likely to answer very rapidly to a different problem. And as far as I know, our African members who already experience this are very happy of the way we were able to disburse very rapidly the amount that they needed. That's the case in Western Africa, for instance, or things like this. So I hope that this new flexible approach to lending, a facility for all seasons, will meet the diverse needs of the membership. But this kind of flexibility is one thing. There's another part of the problem, which in the past has given, has been the trigger for a lot of papers, that big stockpile of reports on this question, which is the question of conditionality. So I would like just to take a few minutes to explain our new approach to conditionality. There's it's no secret. Our programs attracted, let's say, some criticism. people said our conditions were too harsh, too intrusive, and even misguided. And I must say it very candidly, I accept some of that criticism. We made mistakes. The problem is, or the good thing is, that we always try, and we're trying now to learn from our mistakes. Overall, I think that African drought is not really what happens here. I think that overall the PRGF was a success. And the reason why I say that is that countries with a PRGF saw bigger boost to growth than those without the program was defined. Still, we have to make sure that the medicine does not harm the patient. So what did we do? We worked hard streamlining conditionality, focusing on core policy measures that are critical for macroeconomic stability, for poverty reduction, and for growth. What does that mean? It means that when you're looking at a situation in a country having problems, you have core conditions which are directly linked to what is needed to fix the problem. And this condition has to be maintained, because if not, you're just wasting money if you don't fix the problem. But in the past, we also had, when you just scrutinize and look very closely to the past program, you had some condition which certainly were proposing things good for the country, but not directly linked to the problem at stake. And this high number of conditions make it sometimes very difficult to implement the program, and the result was that finally we looked for more and we had less. When I look now across low-income countries' programs, the number of conditions has fallen by one-third compared with the beginning of the decade. So this new approach is, I think, leading to more country ownership of a program. And the ownership of a program by the country is a very important thing, not only in low-income countries, also in emerging countries. The result of this is that finally we see that more reform are being implemented today than in the past. We ask for less and we get more just because it was easier to have the countries cooperating with us and trying to implement what happens really to be directly linked to the problem at stake. The recent reforms have gone further. Our loans no longer include a binding condition on specific measures. Instead, programs will be focused on meeting the overall objectives, giving governments more leeway in reaching their goals. We try also to make sure that programs do not work against domestic counter-cyclical policies. For instance, during the food and fuel prices crisis, we revised inflation target upwards to accommodate sharply rising prices. Other example, in the global downturn, we accepted higher global deficit, higher budget deficit than we had forecast at the beginning before the crisis. Other example, we tried to accommodate the countries to give them some fiscal room to protect the most vulnerable. And again, the protecting the most vulnerable is not something which comes out from ethics or a political view, what should be done. Of course, that's a very important part of the thing, because we all know that in crisis, the poorest and the most vulnerable are even more hit than others. But it's also because we need this ownership of the program. Without the ownership of the program, there is no way for a program really to succeed. So all this gives a very different aspect to the program we are implementing now than to the one we had before. There's still one more component. We all know that the low-income countries lack infrastructures. In the past, IMF low-income countries programs permitted only highly concessional borrowing, typically ruling out the kind of private sector borrowing which is needed to expand investment. From now on, the more flexible approach to debt that we have allows countries to, with, of course, not all of them, those with a lower debt vulnerability, to borrow more from both concessional and non-concessional sources. And that, of course, for some of these countries, open a huge possibility of borrowing more and investing more. So let me try to sum up. The crisis hitting hard the low-income countries, especially the most vulnerable. Domestic policy is doing what it can. And it's a welcome break with the past, where there was no room for any kind of domestic policy because there were no room for fiscal or monetary policy. But despite this, the low-income countries desperately need financing to tide them over. And we must make sure that any global recovery also lifts the low-income countries. So the IMF has stepped up to this challenge. We dramatically increased the amount of lending to the low-income countries. As I said before, we try to deliver it cheaper, faster, and attuned to country needs. But of course, the IMF cannot do it all this alone. Our estimate is that the low-income countries will need something about $55 billion in additional external financing for this year and the next year. And the IMF can provide more or less one third of this through the SDR allocation and the bump up in the concessional lending. So other institutions, other international institutions are contributing too, but still it's not enough. Donors also need to play their part. A further scaling up of aid, at least in line with the Green Eagle's commitment, is urgently needed. And the second point I would like to make in this summing up is that at time like these, there's always a temptation for countries to retreat inwards, to look first at their own problems, to respond primarily to domestic political needs and demand. And I can understand that. All of us can understand that. But we cannot ignore the needs of the low-income countries, especially paying the price for two rich countries' mistakes. So countries must resist the temptation to reduce aid or to engage in trade and financial form of protectionism. If it happens, the poorest countries will suffer. Years of progress may be undone. And beyond this, beyond the economic aspect of it, in many countries, democracy, young democracies, will be at risk, and even peace can be threatened. We all have in mind historical examples which show us how economic distress can slowly go to this kind of attack against democracy and then go on in foreign war. So we cannot let this happen, and it's not only the IMF which is at stake, but it's part of our responsibility, and that's the way we want to work in the coming year, trying to be our part, not letting this kind of thing happening. Thank you. Can I come back to you?
Back to me. Maybe I could ask a couple of questions, and then we'll turn to our audience to see. Come and relax a little, right? Open another water.
Yeah,
won't spill on you.
Wasting water.
No problem. Well, I mean, I think that it's very important to hear from you this big picture. It paints a picture, if you compare the 1990s to the decade to come and the last couple of years, of a really dramatic change in the environment on the issue of things. You know, you said there's openness and even eagerness on the part of the IMF to support counter-cyclical domestic spending. There's a new tolerance in terms of commercial debt and what is sustainable debt. I wonder if you could just say a little bit more. I know it's difficult to mention countries, but among the low-income countries, this kind of change in approach, which basically starts with the assumption that the countries are managing their economies reasonably well, even in the face of domestic political constraints, which all countries face. For example, on the precautionary facility, the rapid credit facility, which has, which is more flexible, it's a more rapid response. Could you say a little bit more about, you know, is there an implicit or explicit set of countries, a list that are eligible? Do countries know about that eligibility? On the issue of, I guess that's the main one, but precautionary, access to the precautionary portion of what might be a standby. You know, what's the deal if you're the finance minister from one of the low-income countries? How do you know? It's a little bit the question and the challenge that was associated with the initiation of the flexible credit line for emerging markets, and it might be interesting for people to hear how you handled the eligibility issue and the need to break through on the stigma with the flexible credit line access.
Mm-hmm. Well, the country is likely to benefit from the PRGF. Our list of low-income countries, and they're all eligible for the different facility that I just described. the fact that we enhance the level of access, you can believe me, they know that. And they all come knocking at the door saying, okay, I had limited access previously, I'm just running my program, I want more, which we're doing. For instance, I was yesterday evening meeting here in Washington President Ouad from Senegal, and the amount, it was in June, I think, I'm just talking about, and July, okay. As Antoinette correct me rightly, in July, not in June, we increased the level of access on the program they have and the possibility of the financing program they have from 35% of quota to 70% of quota. So all the countries are coming and say, okay, you double the possibility, let's have the money. Fine. That's the reason it has been done. So it will be totally illogical to enhance the possibility for countries to ask for IMF money and they say, no, we're not going to give it to you. Now, for this new kind of facility, like the standby, and the question of who is eligible, who is not depending, it's something which has to be treated case by case. As I said before, the reason for the PRGF and the logic of the PRGF, which goes on now with the extended credit facility, is in some countries the needs are long-term needs requiring for some important reform, and we need to be on the side of the country for several years to help them implementing those reforms. For some other countries, we have situations which are, you know, short-term situation. It's always very difficult for me to give names, because if I say this country is at risk, then I can create myself a problem. But let's imagine low-income countries, oil exporter country. I'm not thinking about the biggest one, so don't think about Nigeria immediately. But some others. Because of the change in the price of oil, compared to the forecast they may have themselves and what they plan for the future in terms of spending, they may face a short-term problem. And this short-term problem has to be addressed. For this, the standby facility is perfectly designed. And when I say this, I have in mind at least two of this country we may discuss with and implement this rather rapidly. Then the choice will be precautionary or not precautionary. That depends upon the urgency of the problem. Of course, on a precautionary basis, it costs much less to the country. On the other hand, we could say we earn a little money with this, but that's not our business to earn money. So when it's possible to make on a precautionary basis, which means that the need is not urgent, it's much better. And then it looks very much like the flexible credit line which has been created for emerging countries. Just the amount are not of the same size, of course, but the economies themselves are not of the same size. But in most cases, countries came to us when they have the problem. You know, I hope we will all of us see a time where country will be happy to come to the IMF and will say we better go to the IMF than doing nothing. This time we're not still there, and there's still some kind of stigma to need the help of the IMF. So when countries come and ask us something, it's because they have trouble. They don't come very much before the troubles. So they come because they have trouble. So the implementing the standby facility will need to implement it immediately and not to wait for, not to have a precautionary situation. But again, it's a case-by-case thing. And your question followed up on the flexible credit line, which certainly was a breakthrough for IMF lending, where we try, and I think we succeed at least partly, and it's just the beginning, to address the so-called stigma of countries needing the help of the IMF. And three countries, big countries, Mexico, Colombia, Poland, decided that they want to step in with a facility which is precautionary, which costs very little money, and could concern huge amount for Mexico is something which is close to $50 billion. The result was very good. In the three cases, Mexico, Poland, and Colombia, the day they signed the agreement with the fund, the spread went down on the market, and finally, what they the gain on the spread was bigger than the cost of the facility for they had to pay to the fund, which is small part of the story.
Nice.
Just nice. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is that the markets react very positively, saying, okay, now, saying two things. I don't know which one was the most important. One thing is, okay, now you have so much money at your disposal, there's no way to try to make money on attacking you. That's one thing. And that's the real reason for this facility. The other one is, if the IMF give you this kind of grade, that you're likely to have the flexible credit line with no conditionality at all, which means you have the right policy in place, we just provide you with money, we're not asking anything, any change in your policy, then that it means that maybe you really have the right policy in place, so there's no way to attack you. And I don't know which part of it was most important, but altogether, those facilities proved to be very useful for the three countries using it. So we have to think about it. We're on the way, the global economy is on the way of recovery, so I don't expect in the short term that another country will need to use the flexible credit line, which was designed for the climax of the crisis. But we can have this facility evolving and providing to countries a kind of a substitute to home-owned reserves. In many emerging countries, a lot, not only some low-income countries too, a lot of resources are just sterilized as reserves. And I can understand that, facing what has been the last decade and especially the last crisis. It's just reasonable for countries to say, if we want to avoid being in trouble, we need to have some reserves. On the other hand, it's very costly. So couldn't we imagine a system where the fund will really work as a lender of last resort, being at the disposal of our membership, of a kind of pool of reserve which could be used by the one needed it, avoiding that the country, the individual country, will have to use such a large amount of their financing capacity to just to have a reserve. I think it's possible. It will be the second stage of the FCL or something to build on top of the FCL. I think we need to think about it. Of course, it will. It's different kind of use of IMF resources. It will need, if it goes on the global level, it will need extra resources to do that. But I'm absolutely convinced that to help growth at the global level, and we will need this because beyond the crisis, we all know that the average rate of growth will be lower than before the crisis, then to boost growth, we need all the resources to be used for development, especially in low-income countries or emerging countries. So if the IMF is able to provide this kind of facility and the kind of being kind of insular for the countries, it will release a lot of resources for other topics. One condition for this, of course, and it comes to one of your favorite topics, Nancy, is that the countries need to be confident in the fund. And be confident in the fund for those countries, especially emerging and low-income countries, goes back to the question of governance, voice, representation, and all the which is at stake. So the question of governance, let's say under governance I put everything, the quota, the chairs, the decision-making process, all these kind of things, is not only a question of fairness. It is. But it's not only that. It's also needed because we as the world community, need our membership to be confident in the fund and find that it's their tool, not their enemy. And if it's their tool, they have to feel comfortable. So, of course, to feel comfortable may have different definition when you're talking to different persons, so it's not that easy. But I really expect that the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh in the coming days will be able to make some breakthrough and make it possible that we really speed up the process, which will restore the total legitimacy of the institution, especially as it's considered, when it's looked from the point of view of the emerging countries or the low-income countries.
Maybe I could just follow that up because you anticipated in effect that I wanted to ask a question about governance. And of course, there's been tremendous amount of discussion of the formula and the demands from implicit or explicit from the major emerging markets for greater representation and voice in the fund. I think you make a really interesting point about that's very relevant for the low-income countries, that there needs to be confidence on their part as well. And it seems to me, looking forward, that it will be interesting to understand when and whether there is demand from low-income countries for the precautionary kind of access. That would be an interesting sign of confidence. And so, you know, I'd look forward to hearing as over the next year or two what happens about that. I think the issue, though, is a bit that how from the low-income country point of view do we ensure that confidence is not a function of the leadership now, you know, the recent changes, the fact that there was a crisis, so there was a big push through the G20 to ensure that the low-income countries had some resources as well, that there was the SDR issue essentially because of other factors from which the low-income countries benefited a bit. So it's not quite structural yet. You know, it's kind of at risk. It's vulnerable to a change in the external environment, a change in mood, who knows. So could you say a little bit more about what you sense from the low-income countries on the governance issue? Are they at the moment comfortable to kind of free ride on the discussion? What sort of push is there, say, from the African members to have more representation in the board? Do they complain to the Europeans about the over-representation on the board side, do you think? Just tell us a little bit how you see it from your point of view, and whether there are anything else kind of besides speeding up the reform, which after all in the end is many of the reforms that if they are speeded up, they're still sort of marginal to the fundamental question of more voice, influence, and thus more confidence, and thus more effectiveness.
Let me start with the end. Reforms are very often marginal, but the sum of the reform makes a big reform.
This is a good politician, as well as a good economist. Right? No. Let's be realistic.
I'm just because I'm a reformist. You're a revolutionary. I'm not. So I think we have to do it step by step, but one condition for what I say, not being just speeches and speeches, it's that the step are really implemented. Why do I say that? Because I totally share, as I said before, the idea that at the next meeting of the G20 in Pittsburgh and after, we have to move forward. But what are the emerging countries asking, and the low-income countries together asking for the next shift in the CUDA reform in the IMF, something which lies between 5% and 7%? I'm not arguing if it's right or not, but what they're asking. Good. In 2008, we already delivered the first reform, which has been lasting for 10 years, but I closed it in April 2008. The shift was not that big, 2.7%, but it's one half, less than one half of what is asked today. So it means that if the needed shift is today, let's say 6%, when you take into account the 2.7% which has been done in 2008, meaning in 2008 we did 1/3 of the shift and 2/3 are still in front of us. So 1/3 is not the total move, but it's not ridiculous. Good. The problem is that this has been voted by an overwhelming majority of 98%, or I don't remember exactly, of the governors of the bank at the spring meeting of 2008. It's almost 18 months behind us. But only 35, or maybe today, I don't check the figures every day, 36 or 37 countries out of 186 now had voted this in their own parliament. So one thing is to make the reform. Another thing is going to parliament to have it implemented. And so the 2008 reform is still not implemented, not only on the Kurda side. Remember, part of the reform was also to give the two African chairs a second alternate because they have so many countries to deal with that it was just fair to give them more resources. They don't have it. They don't have it because most of the countries didn't go to the parliament. I can understand it's not on the top of the agenda of most governments, but then what's the use of making a lot of noise about changing the quota if after it doesn't, it's not implemented? And I just want to be nasty, but among some countries which are the more vocal for a change, the next change, they still don't have approved the previous one. So, okay, it doesn't impair in any way the fact that we have to move forward, but we don't need to move forward only on speeches, declaration, or even vote inside the IMF. We need the real stuff to be done, which means the parliaments to vote this in the different countries. Second point, governance reform is not only a question of Kurda, or even not only the question of shares. There's this recurrent question of having too many European shares, which I think is true, but it's not only the end of the story. Governance goes much more beyond this. I have proposed, when I was a candidate to this capacity, that we should introduce something like a rule of double majority. Majority of votes, majority of seat of chairs. As it works, the example was just example of the, as it works in the European Union, that's why I was used to this kind of process. Good. Is it interesting or not? I think yes. Can we do that? I think yes. That's something which has nothing to do immediately with the question of quota. And then you have other question of voice and representation, which goes through something which could be very different. Look, the structure of the staff of the IMF is still a structure where the US plus the advanced economies are all not only overrepresented, but overwhelmingly represented compared to many developing countries. Having people from developing low-income countries, emerging countries, in bigger number in the IMF changes a lot the institution because it gives us another culture of what's the history, the political situation of the countries. And we need this to get rid of the one-size-fits-all policy, which was one of the criticism addressed, rightly addressed, to the IMF. We need not only the will to do so, but also the possibility of having people knowing what they're talking about. And having people knowing what they're talking about means the only way is not only having people coming from those countries. You may be American-born and American-trained in American university and be a very good expert of what's going on in Botswana or in Sri Lanka. But of course, having people from those parts of the world is also a way to do it. So voice and representation, I'm not trying to minimize the question of the quota, but voice and representation is much more than that. And I could give other examples. So now you're right, we will see in 1 year from now, because the decision to create the standby facility is 1 month old or 1.5 months old. So we will see in the coming year how much it has been used. If it has not been used, why? What was the kind of reluctancy or the drawbacks or the problems, and we have to fix it. But one point what you say is very important. One of the biggest events which took place during the last year, during the crisis, and in my view, probably one of the things which will remain in history books in 10 years or 20 years from now, is not that much that the stimulus was 2% or 2.2, and that the exit strategy have been correctly implemented or not, we'll see this later, will be that for the first time in history, we had a huge cooperation, coordination among countries all across the global economy. And the emergence of the G20, which did exist in the past at the level of finance minister but was not very important and had no very a lot of consequences. The emergence of the G20 at the level of head of state and governments making decisions, this decision being implemented, and the result of those decisions creating a new state of the world is something which is of tremendous importance. The question is, it works during the crisis, because there was a kind of a consensus, and this kind of consensus always easier to build when people are scared of what may happen than when we will come back to normal times. So will this consensus, or if not the consensus, at least this working body go on after the crisis, beyond the crisis? And that's my main concern today. We are not still beyond the crisis, but we're still at a point where national concerns, domestic problems may overcome the collective need of working together. So Pittsburgh, again, from this point of view, will be a very good sign of the willingness, or not, I hope the willingness, of the different countries to go on working together. Not always agreeing on everything at the same time, that's another point, but working together. It was clear in London at the April summit, but this was a time where people were really so afraid that they were listening to advice. What's going to happen? I really don't know. I believe that the lesson is a good lesson. How long will it last? I'm not sure. And we all know that if we want this kind of body to work, we need to have some kind of a, it's good to be informal. And at the level of head of states, it has to be informal. You're not going to constrain somebody because of the vote of another one. It has to be a kind of discussion and consensus building process. But nevertheless, you need some kind of organization of this. If you have no organization, the possibility to reach a consensus will not emerge alone. You know, leaders have a lot of concern. They have a lot of problems, domestic problems to deal with. They spend some time on international problems. Good. Decision has to be prepared if you want decision to be made. And so international multilateral institutions like the IMF, like the World Bank, maybe some others, are absolutely needed to, in conjunction with the G20, just make things done. And if what has been decided in April on the new agreement to borrow under resources of the IMF, on the SDRs, on the low-income countries business, has been done, is because you had behind or aside, close to, next to the G20, you had an institution to do it. The past is full of meeting of the G7 or the G8 with nice communique that at the end nobody was reading anymore, just because everybody knows there won't be no follow-up. There's, of course, a theoretical risk that it may happen to the G20. If we want things to move, and the low-income countries to have their take in this institution, we need the institution to be a little organized to go forward. Then organization means also that probably we need to have a new look on the legitimacy of the G20. The G20 is supposed to be the 20 richest country in the world, fine. They're representing 80 or 85%, depends the way you count it, of global GDP, global trade, and all this kind of thing. Fine. Does that mean that if you have 20 countries, 186 other countries belonging to the IMF will just stay out of the room and wait for decision made having some influence on their life and the life of their people without any say by the country? That's impossible. So we need two things. We need, in my view, to have this G20 becoming a G20 plus, means probably bigger than 20, to include some country representative of the low-income countries. It's already being done in London and other meetings. Those countries have been invited. It was very informal, never the same countries, so it's difficult to work. So I think, my view, maybe it's too much French, Cartesian, and some will say bureaucratic way of looking at that, but I accept to take responsibility for this. I think we need to define the way the low-income countries will be part of the process. And the second thing, having done that, is that these low-income countries, in one way or another, will have to discuss, organize, take advice from their fellow countries and the other low-income countries. Of course, everybody understands we cannot have 186 countries around the table and have a discussion. So everybody understands in one way or another, you have to be represented by somebody else. It can be on a rotating basis, it can be, there's a different way to do it, but you have to do it. And all this has to be organized. It will not emerge like mushroom after the rain alone. You have to make it if you want it to work.
Okay, thank you very much. I know many people will have many questions, as I do, on the G20, on the problem of countries self-insuring with reserves. Will the IMF be able to have enough resources to minimize that tendency, on relations with the World Bank, et cetera, et cetera. So it's open to you. Maybe because we don't have too much time, is it okay with you if I take two or three questions?
Of course.
Then you can pick and choose, and then we'll take another two or three. Joe Marie, maybe you could explain the initiative you've, although we don't want to talk only about governance.
No,
so
we're not
be
talking
careful,
only about
please.
Governance. I'm Joe Marie Grease-Grabber with New Rules, and some of you hopefully have been participating in the civil society consultation. There's a website that has been set up in collaboration with the IMF. It's called thefourthpillar.ning, N like Nancy, ING.com. It's open to everybody, including the IMF, including all of civil society. And we have presented a summary paper to the board of directors 2 weeks ago, and we'll be talking with Mr. Strauss-Kahn in Istanbul. And in that paper, the discussion of governance is much broader than voice and vote, shares and chairs. Two central concepts are transparency and accountability. And with that, I'd like to go back to the issues of conditionality. Because you said that the conditionality has changed, but what I read has still a lot of the same complaints, and you say, well, everything is different. In terms of how the IMF does its evaluation of its work, right now I know SPD does a lot of it. Do you anticipate having external evaluators for some of this work? Because right now it's a he said, they said, or DSK said and all the NGOs said, and it's like two worlds. Other than that, I love the thought of having the IMF be the insurance program so countries don't have to carry large reserves. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
As the IMF and the G20 and others.
Would you take the mic? I think probably we're making it.
As the IMF, the G20 and others.
Could you introduce yourself?
Yes,
sorry.
I'm Larry McDonald from the U.S. Treasury Department. As we are working on assistance packages to help the low-income countries, much of the attention, very understandably, is focused on the financing. How much financing, what kinds of facilities, what kinds of conditions, eligibility. My question is, what role do you see, if any, for technical assistance, capacity building assistance as part of this package? At the beginning of your remarks, you noted that low-income countries had made important strides on terms of policy reforms and implementation that suggests strengthening of public financial management and economic policy capacity. I agree with that. At the same time, I think it's going to be tricky for these countries to absorb potentially very large financial flows and different kinds of conditions in ways that are best directed towards growth and avoid the possibility of creating the next generation of highly indebted poor countries. So the question has to do with technical assistance capacity.
Okay, one more in this round. Nancy Alexander.
Hi, I'm Nancy Alexander with the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Thank you very much for your remarks. There's a big gap between what the low-income countries need and what the IFIs are providing. And my understanding of your remark at the end was that it's very important to enlarge the ODA pie so that poor countries aren't paying for the mistakes of the rich countries. And that's a very critical point, but there's very little optimism that ODA will grow, and there's very little optimism about exports, you know, returning to anywhere near their previous levels. And so I'm wondering how you see this moral and financial conundrum. Many people use the example of a Mercedes plowing into a Volkswagen and the Volkswagen owner needing to replace the Volkswagen and pay for some of the damages of the Mercedes. And so what do we do if we can't enlarge the ODA pie? And finally, what's the volume of bilateral ODA the IMF needs in order to subsidize the no interest loans to developing countries? It's certainly important that they be subsidized at the same point. How do we grow this pie? Thank you.
Well, first, I want to thank Jo Murray for all the work she's doing, and we're trying to develop a formal channel of relationship with civil society organization, and that's what we call the fourth pillar, and I think it's very useful. Of course, it can be improved, but already the work which has been done for us is really of tremendous importance, so thank you. Thank you again. Of course, transparency of what we're doing is of crucial importance. Sometimes we have problems, I must say it, when it has to do with something which may be very sensitive on the market, and it happens. You know, the origin of the IMF, and still a large part of what we're doing, has to do with currency and current account deficit and problem on the currency exchange rate, and this is always very sensitive. So you have always this trade-off between being transparent and also at the same time not give information that could harm the country. So we try to deal with this, and certainly we can improve what we're doing. And the same thing is, I mean, it's not the same thing when we're looking backward to what has been done, and when we try to have an evaluation of we did right or we did wrong. Then it's from the past, and it's, of course, less sensitive. So this, from this point of view, we certainly can be more transparent and try to do it. But the crux of matter, what the main point what you say is that, okay, I'm arguing that conditionality has changed. I can produce a lot of charts showing that the number of conditions has decreased and those kind of things. And still, countries are complaining. Yeah, I'm afraid that's unavoidable. You know, I see a role a little as the role of a doctor. You're sick, we try to help you. First, we try to help you when you're not sick, avoiding illness. And that's technical assistance, that political advice, and this kind of things. But as doctors, we cannot guarantee that your country will never be sick. So when a country is sick, we have to help them with medicine and stronger advice. And it's understandable that most of the cases, they don't like it. Medicine are bitter. If things were going well, there would be no need for the IMF. If they ask the IMF to come, it's because something's going wrong. And when something's going wrong, you need to fix it, it's always difficult. Let's get out from the analogy and back to the reality. When a country had, for good or bad reason, political constraint or whatever it is, a huge and increasing fiscal deficit, and that this deficit transfers into a deficit of current account, and they cannot afford it. They come to the IMF for help. We will provide resources, but at the same time, we need to fix the problem at the roots, which is the fiscal deficit. Then we look with the country what has happened in the past, and it appears that for many reasons, I don't want to comment, spending has skyrocketed in the two last years, with pension increasing by 50 or 60%, by this kind of things. I can understand the needs of the pensioners in this kind of countries, but nevertheless, when you can't afford it, you can't afford it. So you need to go back. And then the government say, okay, you're right, we're going to do it. And then they go on TV and say, you know, those bastards from the IMF that ask us to cut the pension. Okay, that's part of the reality. If you really drink too much alcohol and the doctors come and say, you're going to fix this, but you need to drink less, you won't like it. So the fact that country complains does not mean that we are not really trying to streamline conditionality, limit it to really what is needed to fix the problem. Still it will be painful. Still it will be difficult. And so I have no hope. I have some experience of domestic politics. And you know, one of the most difficult things in the European Union is that Brussels, the European Union, is always blamed by national governments for anything going wrong. What's good comes from the government. What's bad comes from the European Union. For the IMF, it's a bit the same way. It goes a little the same way. It's difficult to change that. So we try to be more transparent, explaining more what we're doing, having more outreach, listening to criticism, changing what we do when we find the criticism are right. But there's no way to avoid that even with the best possible IMF, you will have a country complaining just because what we ask them to do is something they don't want to do. Because if they wanted to do it, they would have done it and no need of the IMF. So, you know, it's a kind of a circle. TA, yes, TA is very, very important. Capacity building in this country is absolutely needed. That's part of what the doctor can do when you're still in good health and to avoid to be sick in the future. Especially if we are going, and we are in this process, going to give them much more money than in the past. As I told you before, 2009-2010, we're going to lend four times more than we did in a similar year in the past. So how is this money going to be used? What kind of training they need, capacity building, change in the tax system, change in the custom system, how to run correctly the central bank, all these kind of things is something that we need to provide too. A lot of our resources are devoted to this capacity building business. We're not alone to do that. The World Bank does a lot, other institutions too. We're working very close together, but you're certainly right in saying that it has to go together. It's not enough to say we have huge amount of money and we're going to use this money. This money has to be used wisely, not only not to be lost, but at the same time to build something for the future. And the trade-off between using it for immediate needs, which sometimes are really critical, and to use this money for building infrastructure for the future, including human infrastructure, education, health, this kind of things, is a trade-off for any government very difficult to solve. So our role in this kind of a training new elites, building new capacity is something which is absolutely necessary. And then the third point, which is that basically you say IFIs are fine, but not enough. You're right. As I emphasize myself, we need, besides what can be done by the IFIs, we need that ODA increases. You're right in saying that there's a little optimism. Because when countries, advanced economies, I mean, have problem at home, the first things you want to cut, or the easiest thing to cut when you're facing your own taxpayer, is to cut the ODA. It's understandable. I'm not saying it's the good thing to do, but it's understandable. And so that's why we have to exert a very strong pressure on government to avoid to do that, to commit themselves not to do that. I mean, you know, Gleneagles was a great time, but we're very far from the commitment from Gleneagles. And I'm more interested in what's really happened than in this kind of a general statement that finally don't reflect in the fields. What we're doing will be financed. We manage. And when we decided to create the zero interest rate loans, we will have through the sale of gold that has been decided and will be voted by the board the day after tomorrow. We will have the resources to finance our zero interest rate process. That's fine. But as you said, the total amount that we may lend through this is not enough to cover the financing needs. So we need to go further. Have in mind that the problem is not only subsidies. We need subsidies to increase concessionality and to be able to lend to these countries at lower rate than the market rate. And what we're going to do, as I said, will be to lend at zero interest rate. But we need the subsidy for this, but we need also the loan resources. I mean, when you're lending $100 to an African country, you need $2 or $3 to have the interest rate from this 100 come to zero, but you also need the 100. And the 100 are different kind of resources, that not subsidies. And we are trying to work on a process which is very difficult for legal reasons and technical reasons, but where part of the SDR, which has been created by the IMF itself, could be used to complement the lending resources, which will be a possible use for the SDRs beyond the traditional use, which is to build reserves for central banks. So we're working on that. I don't want to come into the nitty-gritty of this thing, but it's a difficult point technically, but it's not impossible. And if it works, then it will be part of the answer to your question, only part of the answer to your question, but it will be one part of the answer to the question and gives the IMF a kind of new role, helping to finance the low-income countries outside from what directly comes from countries' budgets, which is safer because, as you said, in difficult times, it's the first line in the budget to be cut by those countries.
I'm afraid because it's 1 o'clock and you can imagine that the MD has a very busy agenda that we have to stop. Let me make a few quick remarks in the nature not of conclusions, but just things that I found particularly interesting and important. One is that Mr. Strauss-Kahn referred to the double majority issue, and if we can, we'll try to find the op-ed that he had published in the Financial Times before his election and put it on our website along with some other work of others on that double majority issue. A second is that I think we will make an effort at the center, and I hope others will, to follow up a year or more or less from now on demand from the low-income countries for the precautionary finance arrangement. This is absolutely, it strikes me as just fundamental that we try and move the international financial institutions away from always relying on lending to a little bit more emphasis on risk management and insurance kinds of facilities. And finally, I think we should take note of his very subtle remark on the SDRs. That is a central issue that goes to the heart of all the questions about liquidity in the world, self-insuring problems with countries building up their reserves, returning to a state of global imbalance. And finally, I imagine that there will be some interesting reaction to the MD's view that there should be a G20 plus, which took us right back to the issue we hoped we could focus on today, and I think we succeeded, and I thank you for that, namely the low-income country issues. Thank you all for participating, and please give a hand to Mr. Smith.
Yeah.